Thank you. within us. And we are up to the last verse, so we can all chant responsibly. Sri Guru Karuna Sindhu.
Do not understand the nature of Lord Nityananda's mercy.
no limit to it. So, there are many examples, of course, of this extension of mercy. Haridas Thakur immediately comes to mind, how he was beaten and flogged through 23 villages. And the only thing that worried him was not the pain that he was fine feeling, because it is said that if three villagers, an ordinary person, would have been killed, he was so mercilessly beaten. And yet he tolerated it. And the reason was that he was very worried about those who were hitting him, what would happen to them. And when finally they said, if you don't die, then our lives will be taken by the Muslim leaders, then Haridas Thakur immediately, apparently, became dead. And they threw his body into the Ganga. And he said, I don't want to give you any trouble. And he immediately became like a dead person. And then some miles later on, his body floated down and he came out of his trance and appeared to be normal again. In the Mahaprakash manifestation of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where he showed himself to be the Supreme Lord, he told Haridas Thakur that actually I took the whipping upon my own body, and then he showed the scars on his own body. That is why he did not feel what was happening to you. So, the spiritual master similarly suffers on behalf of Krishna, we can say. He takes our sinful reactions, the karma, and therefore he is considered to be the shelter for the conditioned soul. Nevertheless, we should not take undue advantage of the mercy we get from our spiritual master. Prabhupada said once, Krishna can forgive, he can forgive again. He can forgive again, but he said that a third time, whatever he may not forgive. So we should not think that this can go on and on and on and on. Take unfair advantage is considered an offense against the holy name of the Lord. Particularly, it falls within the category of committing sinful activities on the strength of chanting. In other words, if you think that because I have heard my spiritual master, ocean of mercy, so I can do so many nonsense things and still he will extend his mercy to me, that type of mentality is not acceptable. And Prabhupada said it sometimes. He has commented that sometimes that is the worst offense against the whole thing. So, you know, to balance the statement about the mercy of the Guru, we should also state one should not take unfair advantage of it. Neither one should think the spiritual master is an ordinary conditioned soul. That is also a mistake. Sometimes we have dilemmas because we see that the spiritual master or our devotion to him competes with our feelings or devotion for others. But we should understand that we have accepted our spiritual master as our guide, and therefore we have to remain faithful to him. And if sometimes we become strained in terms of our allegiance, we should always rule in favor of our guru. That may be considered blind, but that faithfulness and loyalty is required for someone to have unflinching devotion. Adhama janara bandhu. Bandhu means friend. So the spiritual master has two addresses here. On the one hand, he's addressed as Prabhu, or master. On the other hand, he's addressed as Bandhu, or friend. He's a friend of the fallen souls. What is real friendship? Real friendship is to help someone in need. If someone is a fallen soul, surely he is in great need. So a friend is a person who lends hand to the fallen to lift them up. A friend shares whatever he or she has with another. So the spiritual master shares whatever he has received from his guru. There's a inheritance. It's described in Chaitanya Chaitamrita. There's a vast treasure house, a storehouse, which is lying there as the claim of each sincere person. And as a disciple, you have every right to claim the inheritance from the guru. That inheritance is all of the wealth, the knowledge, the transcendental knowledge and realization that is coming down through the chain of the cyclic succession. And the disciple has a right to this. So, but you have to know how to get it. You have to ask for it. You have to be also worthy of it. Because when a father has some wealth and wants to leave it for his daughter or his son, he's not going to allow it to get spoiled. If he doesn't think that the children are worthy, he's not going to let whatever wealth there is accumulated through the forefathers to be spoiled in an unqualified child, by an unqualified child. So he tries his best to make the children qualified in order to be able to bestow upon them what is rightfully theirs. It is rightfully yours. Taking birth. This is a second birth. Taking birth within the rite of initiation. You have a right to all that wealth. But you have to not misuse it. Otherwise, it may be taken away. So friendship. Another point is that the spiritual master here is our Prabhu. And in the spiritual world, the spiritual master becomes a friend. And the relationship between guru and disciple in the spiritual world is one of friendship. But we should not unnecessarily become overly familiar in this world. When one disciple asked Prabhupada a question, do you ever feel the separation from your spiritual master? Prabhupada said, that is not for you to ask. That is not for you to ask. In other words, when persons became too inquisitive, I would rather say when persons who were not qualified became too inquisitive, Prabhupada shut the door. He would not respond. I'm sure if they were more qualified, he would have said everything. But he did not, because he understood that they might not properly be able to appreciate all that he was feeling. So we have to become worthy of the spiritual master revealing those things which are made most sacred to us. This Lokanath, of course, is Lokanath Goswami, is the guru of Narottamdas Thakur. His samadhi is there in Vrindavan, nearby the Radharaman temple. But Lokanath, of course, also means the protector of the people. Loka means this world, and it also means people of this world, and Nanda means the Lord or protector. So the guru is our protector on behalf of Krishna. The guru protects. How does a guru protect? By showing us the path of dharma. He shows us the path of religious activity, and he helps us to see what to distinguish right from wrong. Thank you. Narottam says, be merciful unto me and give me the shelter. Deha mora padachoya, give me the shelter of your lotus feet. So the shelter of the lotus feet of the spiritual master, sometimes described as a soothing shelter, cooling shelter. The disciple always aspires for that shelter. And may your glories now be proclaimed throughout the world. So this is the prayer. The next prayer, there are more prayers in this song. The next is Sri Vaishnava Mahima. Mahima means glories. Sri Vaishnava Mahima. The glories of the Vaishnava. And it goes like this. Vaishnava Charana Vrinu Bhushana Koriya Tanu Jaha Vaite Anu Bhavavaya Marjana Vaya Pajana Sadhu Sange Anushana Ajnana Abhidya Parajaya. So we normally end here the song, but the song goes on and it says, I decorate my body with the dust from the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas, because by this one can achieve transcendental realizations. By constantly associating with the devotees, one's cultivation of devotional service is purified and one can conquer nations. And there's a third point by Guru Krishna Chakra. The words Jaha Vaite refer to the person who has decorated himself with the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees. Avidya in this case refers to the desires of Chatur Varga, the four purposes of life, Artha, Dharma, Kama, and Moksha. So the dust of the feet of the devotees, it is said that to get the dust from the feet of the devotees, to get the water which has washed the feet of the devotees, and to get the remnants of the foodstuffs left by the devotees, these three are the most valuable source of transcendental mercy for anyone to get. We see an example of Narada Muni. Simply by getting the remnants of food left by the pure devotees of the Lord, the Bhakti Vedanta, he became a great transcendentalist. So we see what mercy there is in this act. The dust of the feet of the pure devotee are so valuable. And it's said to be, it's interesting, the word bhushana, decorate, is decoration. Of course, we put so much decoration on our head. We wear nice clothing or we decorate our faces. But here it's said that the ultimate decoration for the head is the dust from the feet of pure devotee. There's no better decoration. You can think about this every day, right? When you're decorating yourself, you should say, do I have a little bottle of dust, foot dust, from the pure devotees, to put some of that on me? That's the ultimate decoration. Here it also says that the association of the Vaishnavas purifies one's cultivation of devotional service. That's very interesting, isn't it? Because in the process of devotional service, it's described in Chaitanya Chaitamrita that the Bhakti Lata, the creeper of devotion, is surrounded by so many other weeds which appear to be like the devotional creeper. And these are mentioned in Artha, Dharma, Kama, and Moksha. And it is a fact, if you talk with people who are interested in religion, it's very hard sometimes for them to distinguish Uttama Bhakti, pure Bhakti, Kaivala Bhakti, from Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti, or Karma Mishra Bhakti. In other words, it's very hard for them to distinguish, for example, what is the difference between coming to an Aarti or chanting Hare Krishna as opposed to doing your duty to your family, or as opposed to so many other forms of dharma. But we know there is a great difference. One of the holy name offenses against the holy name is to compare the chanting of Hare Krishna with any of the activities mentioned in the Karmakanda or Gyanakanda sections of scripture. And so, for example, moksha, liberation, certainly most people hold liberation to be the highest principle of spiritual life. But in Nectar Devotion, if you read, you'll see that pure bhakti minimizes the importance of liberation. It's considered to be insignificant. Now, mukti mukulitanjali seva tesma. The mukti, or liberation, waits at the door of the house of bhakti as a doorkeeper, or as a maidservant, or a servant, a doorkeeper. Liberation is not considered to be, moksha especially, is not considered to be so significant as bhakti. In other words, we don't pray specifically for moksha, we pray for bhakti. A devotee's prayer is, let me serve you, Lord, birth after birth. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu makes that statement, right? Birth after birth. But moksha, the desire for liberation, means I don't want to take birth again. Now, we also recognize that this is valuable. We don't want to act. But if Krishna desires, the devotee will do so. A devotee wants pure service to Krishna without condition, not even the desire for liberation or salvation. That's often so considered a selfish motive. Kama, dharma, the word dharma, so many types of dharmas. The whole manas, laws of man, manu. Mana dharma are just so many different types of religious duties to perform. And these are all unclassified here as avidya. And it's said that if the only way to get free from this type of confusion is to associate with pure devotees. Because a pure devotee is on the path of pure devotion and will not become sidetracked by the association of such pure Vaishnavas, you will come to understand what is pure bhakti. And it's very important, because if you don't perform pure bhakti, you can't get the lotus feet of Radha Krishna. You can't get the lotus feet of Mahaprabhu. So this type of avidya is destroyed in association with the saintly Vaishnavas. Then, there's another text, but I perhaps wait for the next class, because it's called Sri Rupa Sanatan Tan Mahima. It's the glories of Sri Rupa and Sri Sanatan, which will be the next class. And it goes on for a while, and for three verses. And then after that comes Shuddha Bhakti Tattva, the truth about pure devotional service. So we will cover these two subjects into two more classes. Let's see if anyone has any questions. We'll stop here. Yes.
You spoke about in the spiritual, the spiritual master disciple relationship becomes that friendship. But doesn't the disciple maintain the consciousness that
no.
the spiritual master
No, no. But it's no longer a relationship of guru to disciple. It becomes granted through.
Is the history forgotten?
If it's needed to be remembered, but why should one? That's like asking, do you remember the spiritual world about your trips in the material world? Do you? Do you think that when you're in the spiritual world, you have to dwell on millions of births to have you?
I just heard the prophet said it was like waking up from a bad dream.
Yeah, so when you wake up from a bad dream, you don't want to keep this about the dream.
But you remember.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
Not detail.
No, you don't. No, not even detail. You don't put it out of your mind. People don't continually dwell on bad dreams. They try to get them. And similarly, the relationship with guru, because we see that in the example of with the example we have from the prayers and songs as an example in terms of the Goswamis and their service, their eternal service to Srimati Radharani and Sanatana and Rupa, who are, you know, especially in the case of Rupa Goswami and Sanatana, they are, you know, the foremost maidservants of Radharani, and others assist them. But their relationship is not like a guru and disciple. It's like a friend and another friend. It's in a friendly mood. They're the same age, and they have the same service need. So it's loving dealings.
But is the relationship still one of assisting them, their spiritual master?
Yes, it is. But it's done more in friendship. The exchange is one of friendship. Not of master servant relationship. There's still the recognition of the closeness of the person who was your guru to the worshipable object, Krishna or Radha or whoever it may be, according to the relationship. So that person is close, and therefore you come closer to the worshipable object by the friendship you have with that person, or by the mood of service you have to that person. Friends also serve each other, but the mood of friendship and service is different than the mood of a servant and a master. Another question, Maharaj. Well, the way we understand the guru and disciple, it's a guru and disciple of different rasas, how does the relationship exist? The example has to be, we have to get the answer from Jagadharma. Bhaktivinoda Thakur discusses this in Jagadharma. And in different ways, the guru will manifest relationships that are appropriate. And there, one was in the relationship, I believe it's been a while since I read fraternity, and one was in the relationship of conjugal, and the guru took appropriate forms. So it's possible to take many forms. I would have to read, I don't have much of it on here, but I believe what I said is accurate, my memory is accurate.
Regarding
the facade. And I think the point is made, it's, you will see your spiritual master, so and so, you know, you will see, and I think the person sees their guru in that worship form. Or that particular form of that's suitable for the relationship they have with Krishna.
You're talking about the guru as an individual or the guru as a principle?
Yeah. I mean, I would like to read some more before I answer this question, so I don't give you an inaccurate answer. It's I read that book. And I'm pretty tired at this point, so the combination is not making for good memory. If someone has John Dharma, then do you have a copy of John Dharma?
I like it, yeah.
If you look through it, then tomorrow or the next day, you can give us the answer. Let's discuss it. Share that with the group.
So I think you will describe that the relationship with the group is always on records.
Always on records. Yes, thank you. And this is why Vaishnavas are essential. Yes, Sri Radha Prabhu wants to emphasize the point that after such a discussion we should reiterate the fact that in this world the relationship is always one of one reference. In other words, if you hear this fact that Bhagavad one day will be friends and you start to bring that friendship into this world and then the fraternal ras, then as I said, then it will be offensive. You know, the guru does not allow that. Maybe more friendly. The Shishya Guru relationship especially this allows for more friendliness. But especially the Shishya Guru relationship is more of one reference. And the Shishya Guru relationship sometimes can be warm. But still it is reverential. Said to that person, that is not for you to inquire. Of course, I don't think someone who was advanced would inquire like that. The question itself, you know, do you ever feel separation from your guru? That's a good question. I mean, we ask that out of our ignorance. But it is prime into the feelings of one's guru. And if he volunteers that information, well, very good.
Would you also address some Margulis instruction and say that one should cultivate an attitude of firm friendship with the spiritual master? If you say that, how should you understand that?
Well, if that's a, that statement, then it's a balance to what Sri Rupa was saying. Cultivating firm friendship and at the same time one reverence. The two are really not very compatible. Friendly feelings and one reverence are not very compatible. Can anybody answer? Yes, Muhammad.
I think you answered it in the sense that...
I'm glad I did. Tell me what I said. Be crazy.
He's the friend of the father. So we can always think he is my best friend because he's saving me, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I give up your own records.
Okay, that's nice. We can think in terms of he's a friend of the fallen, and in that sense he's my best well-wisher friend. But that doesn't make us give up feeling of fallen.
Sometimes a disciple, one should help our disciples will lose faith in their spiritual master, and then they try to take shelter in another institution, one of the Prabhupada's God nephews. And they feel like this is helping their spiritual life because they're getting more inspiration there with their heart. Wasn't satisfied.
I don't think that people necessarily go for a shiksha to somebody else because they lost faith in their guru. I don't think that that's accurate. I don't believe that to be accurate at all. In fact, I think it's quite normal that because our training is not complete, that we should take further shiksha. And I think it's very unfortunate that this woman doesn't know how to recognize the need of disciples for shiksha, for shiksha gurus. And they somehow think that may indicate lack of faith in us. I don't think that is a fact at all. Although I would agree that that it can it can become a disregard if one has to leave one's institution to find such shape shift. Then one is treading on very risky ground. Most religions are like that. The institution is also very important. And I think Prabhupada made his kind of institution quite important. He often said, this kind of my body. And, you know, I think most religious institutions feel that way about their institution. Kamala Sheriff certainly does, the Buddhist Sangha certainly does, ISKCON doesn't, and Gaudiya Mutha institutions do also. So going outside of your institution for shiksha definitely is risky. And it can lead to faithlessness in Prabhupada, I think that's true. But I don't think that in and of itself, taking shiksha from another person indicates that one has lack of faith in one's guru. In fact, it may be that one has great faith in one's guru and one wants to understand one's guru's instructions better. The principle of shiksha guru is certainly there throughout our literature. It's spoken about a great deal. Do you have Shiva Ramaraja's book on the shiksha guru available? Mirabai, do you sell that? Where's it going? Do you sell that book in the gift shop? Huh? Shiksha Guru is called by Shiva Ramaraja. You don't have it? You should get that book. In fact, you should meet me and I'll try to remember some other good books. Because your gift shop is the place where everybody can get these books. You don't have to order many copies, 5 or 10 copies. But that's an important book. It does discuss about the Shiksha Guru, the importance of Shiksha Guru. We don't have much of a culture in this kind of Shiksha Guru. Everybody thinks, I'm getting everything I need from my Shiksha Guru. That's not very likely. And I think that Prabhupada also recognized that, and that's why he spoke a great deal about it.
Your first class, you spoke how when the disciple becomes qualified, he or she receives the knowledge about their spiritual identity from their guru. So if the spiritual master is not physically present, then the disciple becomes...
Say that again?
Let's say that the disciple becomes qualified for this knowledge to be revealed, but the guru is not physically present. So how does he...
The question is that if the gurus, when the disciples qualify, the spiritual master reveals his disciples' spiritual relationship with Krishna. What happens if the disciple becomes qualified, but the guru is no longer physically present? We should understand that the guru can always communicate with the disciple. That's the third point. That the spiritual master is not restricted by physical vahu, but can become in so many ways to reveal. And how the spiritual master reveals is in many different ways. Sometimes the revelation will come by the mercy of Guru through the chanting, Prabhupada said. That means the holy name. By the mercy of Guru, the disciple will chant and gradually understand it. Sometimes the disciple may get revelation by through the agency of another person. A shiksha guru can also reveal it. But generally it comes by understanding gradually. One feels the inclination in a certain way, and then by cultivation gradually it becomes more and more clear. The Prabhupada answers this question directly by saying, the spiritual master will instruct through the holy name. That means through the process of chanting Hare Krishna, one will get gradually realized in all the details. Now there's another system which is followed by the Babaji's in Radhapana, where the guru directly gives at the beginning the disciple's name, form, age, dress, and service in the spiritual world. But that's not the system that brought these systems to service by the town board recommended. So there's a debate among the Gaudi Vaishnavas. The Babajis of Radhakum, who are also Gaudi Vaishnavas, they followed that system. And the followers of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati don't follow that system. They waste the revelation. The Babajis argue that you can't do sadhana properly unless you know those details. And the followers of the Saraswatis, the followers of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, they argue that you can't meditate like that when you're in a conditioned stage. And if you do, it will simply be a caricature. I think probably it will become problematic. So there's a different approach argued by each camp. And the Babaji's actually said the Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's line is not proper, because he didn't get this type of Siddha Pranala. It's called Siddha Pranala mantra. He didn't get a mantra from his guru where he was given all these details. Therefore, he cannot give it to others. But to follow the Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati doesn't agree with that. And in fact, there is no instruction directly from the original six Goswamis of Vrindavan in regard to doing what the Babajis do. This process of it's called Manjari Sadhana, specifically the way they describe it, it came after the time of the six Goswamis. So these are details which will just confuse most people sitting here, but anyway, we follow the line of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati.
I don't know if this relates to what you're talking about, but are you familiar with the controversy between those who say that we must have the diksha line intact for the mantra?
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. Through diksha, but their idea of diksha is not what we understand by diksha. Their idea of diksha is like I described it, where the guru at the time of initiation tells you who you are in the spiritual world. That's what their idea of diksha is. But obviously that's not our process. We said that comes through revelation, through qualification, not simply by telling someone.
You were mentioning about the foot vest, the water, and the prasad. That's pretty much the beneficial substances. So is that a reference to the spiritual master, any Vaishnavas, or only elevated Vaishnavas?
The question is whether foot vest, water, or food remnants are equally beneficial from the guru, another elevated Vaishnava, or any Vaishnava. No, they're both according to the level of advancement of who they come from.
So let's say there's some very new devotee who's just beginning Krishna consciousness, and I take one of these items from him. Will I become contaminated by that? Or should I?
Yeah, well, that depends, of course, on your power of digestion, whether you take some. I mean, I used to sit in the Los Angeles temple when I was a new devotee. I would sit next to the place where the Sunday feast guests would leave their place. But I would just take the samosa. I didn't take the samosas that were bitten. But I didn't take the whole samosa. But you could argue it was from their plate. I don't know if it affected me adversely or not. I got a lot of samosas. I have a whole week's stock of samosa, at least 30 or 40 samosa, which I keep in my drawer. Every day, a few samosa. But I wasn't thinking about making spiritual advancement from them. I was just, I like to eat samosa. Yes, we should take the remnants of advanced Vaishnavas. That really is the point. And actually, no one should want to leave remnants. They said that even sannyasi cannot leave remnants, but the guru may leave remnants for the disciple. But otherwise, everyone should finish everything on their plate. And one should not allow people to touch their feet. And one should not allow people to wash their feet. But the guru may allow these things to the disciples out of this glorious mercy. I think Muhammad realized he was cooking something in the garden. Someone's talking about some moments. There's a certain level of realization. For example, you, as you become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, you can understand a certain amount about a person's previous life or lives by studying their consciousness. And Prabhupada says this, and I think it's not only Prabhupada says it, but there's a text in the Bhagavatam that says that you can, by studying a person presently, you can understand their past and their future. So there is a certain amount of ability to actually understand about someone's past if you can read their consciousness properly.
I mean, I was thinking more in Srila Prabhupada's case, because sometimes...
I mean, do you mean, can the spiritual master tell you what you were doing yesterday at 10 a.m.? I don't think that's what it means. I mean, there is some yogic power. I think that's a yogic power, if anything, more than even, you know, that some yogi may have such a mystic perfection that they can do such a thing. But what are you referring to, particularly with Prabhupada?
Well, sometimes during Prabhupada's time, there's questions of what happened 20, 30 years ago, even when Prabhupada was present. People have asked me that.
And what are you? You mean you're asking you if you can remember the past?
No, if Prabhupada was pre-Kali Yuga, would have been aware.
I mean, I've heard some sadhus say that Prabhupada was pre-Kali Yuga. But Prabhupada said on certain occasions, if you don't tell me something, then how will I know? You know, why did he ask for reports, for example? He asked me to write a report every week. I was his disciple, and I was a leader and manager of his movement. He wanted to report every week. Well, if he's treated well, why did he want to report? I could say just so that you would get the benefits of reporting. I don't bother. That's not my experience. I think Tripalakya means that, you know, you understand the past, the present, and the future according to what Krishna needs wants you to understand. Could Prabhupada do it? All right, yes. I'll say yes. The spiritual master can't do it. At least I'll say he could do it. Did he do it? Well, he didn't indicate that he did. The guru knows what you're... But, you know, there's other times where Prabhupada was asked, you know everything. He said, I'm not Krishna. I'm not God. So he didn't seem to map the meaning of Tripalakya to mean, you know, that I know everything like God knows everything. That's what God's power is. Guru is not God. He's a servant of God. And he knows what he knows by the grace of God. But he's not God.
The point where someone is practicing very sincerely the five Vedic principles of chanting 16 rounds, any voting beyond that point, isn't it dangerous to judge their advancement to triumph?
Is it dangerous to judge a devotee's advancement? Well, everything is, I mean, the word danger, what does it mean? I guess you mean committing offenses. The danger might be that you'll think someone's not advanced. But judgment is not wrong. To judge is not wrong. in the sense that you have to be able to discriminate. There are symptoms of advancement, which you can see in a person. So, I'm not quite sure what you mean, but I think that the problem with what you're saying is that it's good in one sense what you're saying. You're saying don't judge people and become offensive towards them. They may be advanced. But on the other hand, what you're saying, the danger of what you're saying is that age everybody is sort of, it's sort of this wishy-washy type of existence where, yeah, be humble to all Vaishnavas. I agree with that. At the same time, we give special respect to those who we consider advanced. According to what you're saying, we won't be discriminating an advanced devotee from a neophyte person. So I think somehow the two have to be balanced. Ladies, some questions?
Proper to teach children to respect their elders by their touching their feet sometimes during that day of life?
That'd be nice. That's a nice process. It's not in our culture of America, but it's certainly part of the Indian culture. It's part of Vedic culture that children should touch their parents' feet when they get up, when they first see them. You're supposed to do that with any elder, any respectable elder, you should show respect to them. But one of the ways to do it is to touch their feet. But the parents should act in a worthy way also. No use saying touch my feet if you're not acting as a proper father and mother. So it has to go both ways. That's true of any type of authority. It can't be misused. If it's properly done, then surely those who are dependents should always touch the feet and show respect in whatever way they can to those who are they dependent upon. That's our system. That is a Vedic culture. That is being destroyed in the modern world. Like, for example, a child should never address a parent by their name. That's disrespectful. You're supposed to say, father and mother. You don't say, and I sometimes see that children, in America, I've seen children address their parents by their name. And that's not, I can't imagine. There's this tendency in modern societies that sort of make everything one, bring everything down to the same status. Everything is on the same status as pure spirit. So all living beings have equal status as parts and parcels of Krishna, spiritually, potentially, eternally. But within this world, there's this distinction that has to be made. So simultaneously, one is different. That's the truth of it.
Is it also appropriate for children to take remnants of foodstuffs and flakes?
Yes, it's proper for the children to take the remnants from their parents' plate. One time, to give you an example, we were staying at a place, and the famous Gita, in India, Gita Press, in Gorakhpur. So we were staying at the guest, Prabhupada and a few of us, at the guest house of Hanuman Prasad Poddar, who was the founder of Gita Press. And they had cows there. And the devotees would, sometimes when they finished eating, they'd give the food, the plate, it was a leaf plate, and they'd put the leaf plate and everything else and feed it to the cows. When Prabhupada heard about that, he became very angry. He said, you can eat the remnants from the cows, but you can't give them your remnants. Because the cow is mother. You can't feed your mother. Of course, out of affection, a mother will eat what her children leave. That's out of affection. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the parents eating whatever their children. That is out of affection. But actually, from a respect point of view, but out of affection, that happens. sometimes, especially with a young child, with young children, they'll be a little, sometimes the mother's feeding the child and feeding herself in the same place. That's out of love. Love doesn't have such a boundary. There's no boundaries like that in love. But I can only cite the example with the cows. Even in India, when you're making chapatis, if you're living in a village, who do you give the first chapati to everybody? The cow. I saw Krishna Bhagavat, my disciple in Vrindavan, whenever she makes chapatis, first thing she does, the first chapati, she goes out on the street and looks for cows. First she feeds the cow, then she'll feed her guru. The cow is so respected. Here, who are you going to go? You're going to go out on the street here. What do you find? You won't find the cows.
Cowboys.
Cowboys. What's that?
Spot.
Who is that?
You might as well.
You don't mind it. Yes, Mom.
In 4-8, when the son, age of 13, he's given, at least in Brahma family, he's given to that samskara. At that point, the mother touches his feet. He becomes the man that she's expecting.
Yes, Mohammed says in Jagannath Puri, he's just read my book from Jagannath Puri, sharing his wisdom with us now. He says that in Jagannath Puri, when a boy reaches the age of 13, then he gets the sacred thread. And at that point, as a twice-born person, the mother touches his feet, and he becomes a man in the family. Huh?
13.
13.
Judaism.
In Jewish tradition, saying.
Yeah.